consist of three parts, the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. They've got six legs, and the typical insect also has two pairs of wings. So that's kind of what an insect looks like and what an insect does.
What are the most common errors in people believing something is an insect which when it is not?
Oh, gosh, lots of people think that things like spiders or ticks and mites might be insects. But to be an insect, it has to have those three body parts, three pairs of legs and two pairs of wings. But, of course, just to throw us off the scent to some extent, things like fleas, for example, at some point in their evolutionary history, they have had wings, but they've evolved to be wingless. So it kind of, in order to qualify as an insect, well, in a way, we'd have to look back in time at their evolutionary history. But generally, three body segments, three pairs of legs, and then you've got an insect.
I love the fact that crunchy on the outside and chewy on the inside. Yeah. Is a double-decker bar an insect? No, it has no legs. Thank you very much. I'll clear that up.
Dave, were you one of those children that liked insects, that collected them?
Not especially. I think probably because I read a couple of those books that Robin was referring to. So they were sort of part of horror to me. They were things that were repellent. And I'm one of those people who thinks of spiders as insects, and I think scientists are wrong. on this, and anything that you think is an insect is an insect, and while I'm here, whales are fish and tomatoes are vegetables.
Amaret, you described yourself as a forensic entomologist, which means you work with insects, or insects are integral to your work. Could you describe
Yes.
what that is?
Well, insects are everywhere, basically. They're ubiquitous, which is what makes them so incredibly successful. And the main insect that I use in my work is the blowfly, because they're just natural recyclers. They're really amazing creatures. You know, if we didn't have blowflies, then the countryside would just be knee-high in carcasses of hedgehogs that didn't quite get across the road, etc. So blowflies are just amazing recyclers, and they recycle human bodies as well. So if you drop dead, then blowflies will find you, and they will lay their eggs on you, and they'll start feeding on you as maggots. And basically, if I can work out how old those insects are, then I can work out the minimum time that person's been dead.
So when did we become aware of insects being, you know, something we can use in this story of life and death?
Well, the first documented case of forensic entomology was actually in China in the 13th century, when a murder had taken place, and it looked like the wounds had been made by a sickle, a rice sickle. So an investigator...
Is that a cereal?
Cereal killer.
This is one of those moments where I hope this doesn't turn out to be a really melancholy story about murder. Hoping that 700 years is long enough to make the ricicle joke. But we'll find out, because Radio 4 does have a way of finding the right complainant for the right show.
Yeah. So basically, the investigator came along, he got all the local farmers to bring their own sickle, because they all owned their own sickle, or scythe, if you'd rather call it that, and they laid them on the ground in the midday heat, and flies came along and landed on one particular sickle, because there were still traces of blood on it. And so the owner of that particular sickle then owned up to the murder. So that was the first documented case of forensic entomology.
We don't see enough use of insects in old Columbos. That's what I would like to say. Tim, can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of insects? Why, you know, we get this point where suddenly this incredibly successful group appears on the Earth. Can you give us a little bit of the background?
Yeah, so about 500 million years ago, this group called the arthropods emerged in the sea, these things with a jointed external skeleton, and they kind of bumbled around for 100 million years or so. Then about 400 million years or so ago, well, they were on the land by that point, and the insects evolved. So they come from within that larger group. Now, it used to be thought that insects were much more closely related to things like millipedes and centipedes, but actually somebody's done some genetic analysis quite recently and discovered that insects are actually a kind of derived crustacean. So they belong to that group that has the crabs and the lobsters and the shrimp and woodlice and things like that. So they possibly evolved from something that was maybe a land-living, something like a woodlouse. And basically, they have dominated every terrestrial ecosystem since then, from then up until the present day. So they were around, they saw the evolution of the flowering plants and they co-evolved with those and they diversified with those. They've seen the dinosaurs come and go. They saw those early tetrapod vertebrates, the four-legged vertebrates, come out of the sea. They've seen the rise of the mammals and they'll probably see the demise of the mammals as well. That's my suspicion.
Can I just question, a couple of times people have said the most successful group. I don't think a headcount is the only way of measuring success. If you go to my house, you'll find three humans, one cat, and no doubt loads more insects, but I feel like we're more successful than them. It's my house. I don't think the fact there's more of them than me.
And to be fair, I know you've got at least one BAFTA, maybe more. And I don't think they've got any.
We could put it a slightly different way. If you think about complex life in our galaxy, now, if I've got it right, that there's a decent likelihood that planet Earth is the only planet in our galaxy that holds complex life. And if you look at the typical version of that complex life, let's add up the number of species, for example, of everything else that's not an insect. So the number of species of complex things like plants or vertebrates. So you can add together the birds and the mammals and the fishes, amphibians and reptiles, all of the other invertebrates that are not insects. You soft things like your jellyfish and your worms. You add all of those up together and they don't come close to the number of different species of insects that exist. So you could actually say that the normal way to be a complex life form in our galaxy is to be an insect.
Not for Dave. Dave's saying, but none of them have got any sofas. I mean, this is weird. I've got two sofas.
You mentioned something interesting there, just in passing almost, which you said they co-evolved with flowering plants, which is an interesting idea. So the fact that the flowering plants wouldn't be present on Earth without the insects, and possibly vice versa. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, completely. So when the insects first came about, well, the plants were not as complicated as they are now. They were kind of simple things like mosses, basically. And the plants are basically as complicated as they are, partly because of insects, because the insects evolved to pollinate plants, but they also evolved to feed upon plants. So then plants came up with defenses, and you have these evolutionary arm races. And most species of plant have some kind of insect life cycle that is just very deeply intermingled with it. So really, one of those two groups probably couldn't have evolved to the diversity that they've reached without the other.
You mentioned in the introduction that your favourite insect is a flea.
Yes. So
why?
Yes. Fleas just have the most amazing lifestyle. I mean, they're obligate parasites. So the adult flea has to feed off a host of some sort, which is generally a mammal, birds, bats, etc. And they're just beautifully designed, really, for that parasitic lifestyle. So they have this exoskeleton, which is very, very hard to crush. They're laterally compressed, so they can move through the fur of their host. They have backward-pointing spines, so it's very difficult for the host to actually get rid of them by preening themselves. So they just have lots and lots of different morphological characters that are just beautifully designed for their specific lifestyle.
And what, just in your work, is there any use of fleas in terms of forensically, or will they, if something dies, is it right that they would leave the body?
Yes, so fleas like warmth, basically. So as soon as an animal dies, they will jump off that animal and find another host. So fleas are not generally involved in forensics, but in fact, the first ever case I did actually involve fleas, which is a very sort of simple case, and it'd be great if all cases were that simple. But it did actually involve fleas.
Well, I'm not going to let you stop there.
Oh, okay.
That's far too enigmatic. It involved fleas, but please move on. If you can talk about it, are you allowed to talk about it?
Okay, yeah. So very, very simply, the police called me up because they had a house where they believed a murder had taken place. The people that owned the house had thrown out a carpet because they said that they had a very heavy infestation of fleas. And they had three dogs, so, you know, it's not impossible. So the police wanted to know, is this a good enough excuse for having thrown out a carpet, that you've got such a heavy flea infestation? So I said, well, it's possible. However, these days, we don't have quite such a problem because we all have vacuum cleaners. And the immature stages of fleas actually live in kind of carpets and soft furnishings and basically the nest of the host. So I had this really bright idea. I said, well, why don't you find out if they've got a vacuum cleaner in the house? And if they have, then send me the dust bag out of it. And so that's probably the worst job I've ever done, is going through somebody else's vacuum cleaner. I did find evidence of a few fleas, not a heavy infestation at all. So the police then went back to them and said, okay, we've consulted a flea expert. She says you're talking rubbish. You don't have heavy infestation of fleas. And so the couple then confessed, and they said actually it was our son who did kill somebody, and that's why we threw the carpet out. Mm. So.
Mm. Wow. I mean, any time I see anyone taking a carpet out, I suspect there's a body in there. Yeah. It always looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
for actually to be one.
There's a fascinating thing about fleas that lots of people have come across this, whereby if a house or a flat has been left unoccupied for a period of sometimes months, but sometimes up to a period of years sometimes, and people walk into the flat, people have told me that this has happened to them, and all of a sudden the carpet is alive with fleas. And what's actually happening is that the fleas stay in their pupal stage, or the stage between when they're a kind of wriggly larva and an adult. And they can stay in that stage, and it also a kind of form of suspended animation, until they get some stimuli, like some body heat from a host or some carbon dioxide or some movement. And then literally within seconds, they can emerge from that pupal case. So you could have a cat that's been walking around and dropping these flea eggs off, and then they're staying as pupae in the carpet. But then as soon as somebody walks into that house, well, the house can literally explode with fleas.
Mm. It's very...
you're itching now, aren't you? Once you start that second bit, I've got the whole thing. Yeah.
It's interesting. You meant this interesting life cycle that fleas, but I suppose all insects have. Could you talk a little bit about that life cycle and how long they can exist in these various phases?
Yeah, well, actually, not all insects have this life cycle. So there are a couple of ways to be an insect. One of them is to go through what we call complete metamorphosis, which is where you have this kind of two-stage life cycle. So if you think of a stereotypical caterpillar turning into a cocoon or a pupa and then turning into a moth or a butterfly. So that's one way of doing things. The other way of doing things is incomplete metamorphosis. So something hatches out of the egg, and it basically is a kind of miniature version of the adult. So a cricket, for example, a baby cricket looks like a miniature cricket, but without the wings. So it just gets the wings the last time it sheds its skin. And this complete metamorphosis is probably one of the reasons why the insects have become so successful. So the four most diverse kinds of animal on the planet, the wasps, the beetles, the flies, and the moths, they all show this complete metamorphosis. And in evolutionary terms, it's a brilliant trick, because it means that you've got almost two species squeezed into one. So think about the most important things to do. It's basically to eat and to reproduce. And so within one species, like a butterfly, well, you've got one half of the life cycle, which is perfectly designed by natural selection to take on as much food as possible, this expandable caterpillar that's just an eating machine. And then you've got another side of the life cycle that is perfectly designed by natural selection to reproduce, to disperse, and to find a mate and to lay eggs. So it's a fantastic way to be an animal.
Yes, I mean, to turn a caterpillar through this process into a butterfly, which is an incredibly intricate machine.
Yeah, so
it's just almost unimaginable.
We do understand the hormones that control it, for example, and we understand some of the cellular processes. But yeah, people are starting to understand a little bit more. Now we've got things like micro CT scanners. So basically we can put one of these things into a machine and we can actually see inside it without destroying it. Whereas in the past, of course, the only way to do things would have been to dissect these things at various different stages. But now I've seen some wonderful time lapses of these insects, and it looks like magic, basically. Everything just kind of dissolves, and then this completely new insect that is unrecognisable just forms from this cellular soup inside.
It's so nice that you and I agree on we don't quite understand how this works. Really comforting. Do you find, Dave, because when I was a kid, and it was like, you know, on the Sunday night when they used to have the nature documentaries, I always wanted it to be like lions and tigers and elephants. And then the older you get, for some
meerkats.
Reason...
Meerkats.
Meerkats as well. But the older you get, the more that you go, oh, I don't want mammals again. Mammals seem so samey. And suddenly you become fascinated by, you know, insects. Whenever I see any of those kind of, you know, the life in the undergrowth kinds of, suddenly, and I don't know why, as a kid you kind of seem to want things that are more, I suppose, closer to what we are. And then the older you get...
I don't know if it's that, or if it's just that the technology that is available to filmmakers now allows you to show life on that scale in a way that is utterly fascinating, whereas actually when we were kids, you could put a little camera down a hole and you could see, but you couldn't see
that kind of development and that kind of, and now you can. Whereas you could always point a camera at a lion killing an antelope.
Well, you've hit on one of the great advantages, I think. The my favourite property of insects is that none of them are very big. Which I would like. The question is why? Why are they in general? I mean, what the biggest thing is about the size of your hand. It's a beetle, so isn't it?
They get up to about hamster size, medium hamster size.
Medium hamster.
Yeah, but people talk about it. So there are fossils of...
But hang on, you just brushed that aside. That's terrifying. Yeah. An insect that's medium hamster size.
And I've brought some of it with me today. Yeah, here we
are. Can you draw us a picture in words of this medium hamster size insect that Dave really wants to know?
Can I say, genuinely...
He wants to imagine it vividly in his mind.
Everyone always thinks of Brian as cool and brave. One out of the two of us. But when we said we were doing insects today, Brian just went, oh, they're not going to bring any in, are they? Properly like, oh, no, I'm crawling.
I sometimes have to sort of get hold of them. We filmed Wonders of Life in Australia where I had to play with some of the big beetles, the rhinoceros beetle, it's called, which is one of these very large insects, isn't it? But just paint a picture of the large insects and then tell us why they're not any larger.
Yeah, well, before I do, there's an interesting fact about going back to fleas, actually, about the difference in size. So fleas are parasites, and the biggest species of flea in the UK is the mole flea, which gets to about 8 millimetres long. And the smallest species of mammal in the UK is the pygmy shrew, and occasionally the mole flea is found on the pygmy shrew. And I've heard it described as a bit like a human being infested with Jack Russells. So I think I was lucky that we're not that small. Yeah, but it's true. It's true that insects don't get very big. There are some fossil insects of giant dragonflies or dragonfly-like insects in the Carboniferous period a few hundred million years ago. Now, the oxygen levels were much higher then, so perhaps they had a bit more energy to fly around. So the energetics were definitely different then. But actually, the biggest insects that exist, or the longest insects that exist now, are these stick insects from Southeast Asia, from Borneo, and possibly from China as well. And they're about the size of one of those huge dragonflies. So they get well over a foot long, massive, massive stick insects. So actually, these prehistoric insects have never been orders of magnitude bigger than they are today. And yeah, the biggest insects, or the heaviest insects at the moment, some of the Goliath beetles, for example, yes, so they would fit in the palm of your hands, but very, very big, chunky things. Now, probably the main reason why insects don't get any bigger than that is because, now, they're so successful because of this external skeleton. It's like a Swiss Army knife. You can produce any kind of tool with it. But it does mean that in order to grow, they have to shed their skin periodically. So this tough external skeleton can't grow. It can only stretch up to a point in certain kinds of species. So they have to go through this process of shedding their skin, which means that they're very, very vulnerable. So if you imagine something like a grasshopper or a locust, it has to literally step out of its exoskeleton. And at that stage, it's very, very vulnerable until the new exoskeleton hardens off. It kind of tans in the oxygen of the air. So if an insect's got much bigger than the size of, say, a hamster, well, at that point, when it's very, very vulnerable, it would just collapse under its own weight. So that's probably one of the main limits of the size of insects.
What if, say, a locust was in a tin of peaches? How protected would that be?
Hypothetically, yeah. I don't know.
Actually, Emre, you'll know this, because this is always what worried me about Guy and Smith's locusts, which is how... Because it's basically, just to give you a bit of the background, as they move house, they take some peaches that were sent to them by some American friends that have these malevolent locusts in them. In terms of survival in a thick syrup, how... Because you'll know about this... Is that likely? I mean, we're talking about export, we're talking about travel, we're talking about... I mean, how long do you think...
No, they still need to breathe, so they need to be, you know, have access to air. This is why the maggot is just so perfectly formed, is that they actually have their posterior spiracles. So what they breathe through is on the back end of the maggot. So they can basically feed head down into whatever it is they're feeding on, while breathing at the same time.
What would you do if you did that?
I'm not sure it's broadcastable, but...
We both worked with some novelty acts in the 90s, didn't we, Dave?
No, we ran out of time, but one of the Well, maybe it's a myth, maybe it isn't surrounding insects. You often hear it that cockroaches in particular, very tough things, and people say cockroaches, if we have a nuclear war, then the cockroaches will survive. Is there any grain of truth in that? Are they that tough?
There is a bit of truth in it. So we know that insects in general are able to survive a much higher level of radiation than humans. This is one of the things that entomologists do things like that, pop insects into a radiation oven to see what survives. We're nice like that. But yes, our insects can survive a much higher level of radiation than humans can. It's possibly due to the fact that they are not... they're not replenishing their cells all the time in the way that we are. So because they have this growth that is split up into stages, so because they shed their skin in intervals rather than just renewing themselves all the time and like we do, well, it means that their metabolism is a lot slower and that proliferation of cells is not interrupted quite so much by the radiation as it would be in humans. Now, cockroaches, people possibly think about cockroaches because cockroaches can quite famously survive without their head for quite a long time. The insect brain is actually split up into each of the segments of an insect. So each segment has this kind of sub-brain all the way down the body. Insects, the circulatory system and the respiratory system is very different to ours. So they don't breathe through their mouth. They actually breathe basically the air just kind of wafts in through holes in the side of their body. So you can actually take the head off a cockroach. Because they don't have the same circulatory system, they don't have high blood pressure like we do, so they don't bleed out as a human would do if he took his head off. So the cockroach can basically live. It can live and it can respire and it can live for a couple of weeks without its head. So they are very tough things. Whether they would survive a nuclear attack, well, we don't know really.
And if someone was bitten by a radioactive cockroach, what superpowers would they have? We asked the audience if you could be any insect, what would you be and why? And here are our audience answers, which include a silkworm, because I'll be able to make my own clothes when things get expensive after Brexit.
Isn't it a great sort of this 50s reference? An ant, because I have high hopes.
Nice.
You remember that
nice
song?
Ladybird, always have something to read.
A 2,000-year-old bee, because that would be a BBC. Wouldn't would it, actually? Because 2,000-year-old, it'd still be AD, wouldn't it? 2,018-year-old bee.
Actually, I'm not sure that... Anyway, let's not get into that now. Okay. Good. So, thank you very much. Have you got any more there?
Can I tell you why Avalanchurus is my favourite species of... a trilobite.
It does make a lovely bookend, and it does show that you've been using Wikipedia during the show.
it's my favourite species of trilobite, because there are four species within it, and all named by the same scientists. And you know, give you an example of one of them, Avalanchurus lennoni. So they've named it after John Lennon, to put the I on the end. Then the first two are lennoni and stari. You've got Lennon and star. You know, well, I know where this is going. And the next two are Simoni and Garfunkeli. I just love the person who went, we've got four, we'll do two of the Beatles. Not Harrison and McCartney.
Thank you very much to our panel, Dave Gorman, Amaret Whittaker and Tim Cockerell. Next week we're asking, is our universe a simulation? And if it is, if all of this is just something that's been programmed by a teenager on a coding course, and if it is all a simulation, I would like to know, why has the simulator put so much effort into simulating Brian Cox and so little into simulating me? He appears to be about 30 terabytes stored on a RAID 5 array, and I appear to be on a floppy disk. Anyway, so thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Turn that nice again.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince, and welcome to the first episode of the 17th series of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Or in hexadecimal, 1-1.
Right, so that's... Yeah, don't laugh at a hexadecimal joke, Zeb. That was a typical thing for this audience to do. Some of them deliberately laughed as if they understood what
you
said.
It's base 16, isn't it? So it's 1-16 and 1-1, so 15 of the F.
Yeah, well, that saved a lot of time. Anyway, the what I loved is one man down there went, yes, yes. So, anyway, today's show is all about...
Spandau Ballet.
Sadly, this is not about the science of Spandau Ballet, because the producer said we couldn't do that.
Well, it's a part where the new BBC's public service remit to bring artificial balance to everything, in this case, the airwaves, by placating new romantics.
Yeah, well, it's worse than that. They've started using synth players from 1990s pop bands. Anyway. Oh, that's some of them happy with that. Someone uncertain. Today's show is called When Two Stars Collide, and it turns out that the answer is...
Gold! Stop doing that. It's not about gold, it's about this year's Nobel Prize-winning discovery of gravitational waves. Ripples in space and time predicted by Einstein a century ago and first detected by the LIGO experiment in 2015. The gravitational waves were caused by the collision of two black holes. In 2017, LIGO announced that they had also detected gravitational waves from the collision of two neutron stars. And subsequent optical observations of the collision revealed that large amounts of...
was created in that collision. This is the first time we've used Spandau Ballet in the intro, and it's probably the last, so enjoy this level of show business. Anyway, to help us discuss gravitational waves, neutron stars, and possibly the wavelengths of Tartan on Top of the Pops in 1982, if we have the time, we are joined by three physics graduates, and they are...
Hello, I'm Nils Andersson, Professor of Applied Mathematics from the University of Southampton, and the cosmological event I'd most like to observe is neutron stars crashing into black holes.
And I'm Professor Sheila Rowan. I'm Professor of Experimental Physics at the University of Glasgow. And the cosmological event I'd most like to observe is the Big Bang itself.
I'm Darwin. I'm the Emeritus Professor of Cosmology, Archaeology and Biology at the combined Oxford University. And it's been, you know, a heady time for me. So, yeah.
And this is our panel.
Yay!
Can I just ask you, by the way, to do your popular stargazing catchphrase? Unfortunately, it's a bit overcast tonight.
You know, we don't say that as often as you think. My catchphrase is usually, well, we're out of time, and, well, we can't get to that, or saying to some incredibly, like, important scientist, and that's why you won the Nobel Prize, yada, yada, yada. Let's move on, all right?
My favourite one was which really had shouting in our ear when it was, I'm sorry, Buzz Aldrin, I've got to stop you there because we've got to go over to K9, a metal dog who's going to ask a stupid question.
Yes.
And that was my favourite. This is
the fictional robot dogs always win. So let's start off with you, Sheila. I suppose we should define, as we're going to be talking about gravitational waves, what is a gravitational wave?
Gravitational waves, mathematically, are a prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity. But that probably doesn't leave people feeling very enlightened as to what a gravitational wave is. But we're quite lucky in that Einstein's theory, general relativity, describes how space-time and mass interact with one another. So how do gravitational waves fit in that? Well, if you imagine our universe, first of all, as empty. It's an empty space. In fact, imagine it as a flat, empty sheet, flat, empty rubber sheet. There's nothing there, no stars, no mass. And then we come along and we add a star to this universe. So we put a star on our flat rubber sheet, and the mass of that star causes the sheet to curve. In Einstein's picture, that curvature caused by the mass we can think of as gravity. And mathematically, that's what general relativity says. So we've got the curvature of our universe, the space of our universe, caused by mass. Say that mass moves. Say it's a star and it's got the end of its life, it's run out of fuel, its core has collapsed down suddenly, the star's exploded. That mass on our rubber sheet suddenly moves. It changes the curvature around it. And in fact, it sets up ripples that travel out across that rubber sheet. So what we have there is changes in the curvature of space. Those traveling waves, are gravitational waves. And what general relativity does is mathematically describe that. But to us, it feels actually like tiny changes in the direction of gravity here on Earth that have travelled across the universe to us from exploding stars or colliding black holes, massive astrophysical events far out in the universe.
Because these events are, I presume, you know, going around across the universe, these are occurring. So gravitational waves are passing through us now, gravitational waves from many different directions.
That's right. We are all the time being bathed in these gravitational waves. And physically, that has a meaning. If you think back to our rubber sheet analogy, as that sheet was curved, it was stretched. As those waves rippled across the rubber sheet, they were stretching and squashing the fabric of space itself. So as we sit here on an Earth and are bathed in these gravitational signals coming in from the cosmos, the whole time we, the Earth, the room, everything around us is actually being stretched and squashed just a little bit. Fortunately, just a little bit. Otherwise, we'd notice, but it's a tiny, tiny effect. And that's the effect that we've been searching to measure, actually, for about the past 40 to 50 years.
Dara, have you tried to ever explain such complicated issues on a...
on a television, on a broadcast. Actually, last week I was in Belfast discussing Brexit, so yeah. And it was something we'd actually couldn't get any resolution of, whereas this, I think we've got it nailed. It is, and I'm sure my esteemed colleagues will back me up on this as an analogy. Robin, if you're having any difficulty, imagine a trampoline, you're a parent yourself, imagine a trampoline, imagine a child running on a trampoline, and imagine getting a second child to run towards that first child. And a gravitational wave is what your wife senses in the house. What is happening in the garden? What has he done now? Just at the moment, just before impact. That's how fast it goes. That's an incredible thing. How quick it is that your wife goes, what, from the house? Just as you're arranging this experiment.
Niels, Einstein first predicted gravitational waves about a century ago, not long after the publication of General Relativity. So why has it taken so long, a century, for us to detect them? And was there any doubt as well about their existence?
Yeah, you can say that. The first 50 years were doubt, and the second 50 years were trial and failure, I think. And then finally, after about 100 years, in fact, almost exactly 100 years, success. So if you look at the first 50 years, basically, people couldn't agree. Einstein himself famously wrote a paper at some point quite a few decades after the prediction, where he first wrote the paper saying, oh, gravitational waves, no, they don't exist. And then he was criticized by a colleague, so he said, oh yes, of course, gravitational waves exist. And then in the final version of the paper, said, oh, maybe. So I think that's one of the classic hedging your bets kind of in science things. The reality is it was not until the late 1950s that people started agreeing that, yes, these things did exist, and there was no doubt we should be able to catch them in theory. But as Sheila said, they are absolutely minuscule. And so to build a ruler, if you like, to measure this stretching and squeezing of space and time is an astonishing experiment. And I'm glad, as a theorist, I don't have to worry about actually doing these things. That's Sheila's job. And so the next, from the late 60s until 2015, was essentially trying to build this ruler. And don't ask me how it works, because that's Sheila's job.
I'm sorry, that's literally the point of you being here. and that is, you cannot do that midway through.
So perhaps you could describe, first of all, what this experiment looks like.
Sure. What do these instruments look like? We take light, and we use light as our sensing device here. We take light from a laser. We split the light beam into two. And we effectively have a half-silvered mirror to do that. A bit more complicated than that, but that's the principle. Splits the light into two, and that light travels out at right angles to one another. Two perpendicular paths, travels out, bounces off mirrors, and those mirrors are our markers in space. We've put them down, carefully positioned them, isolated them from all other things we can think of that could make them move. We bounce the light beams off those mirrors, let the light travel back, and that light's a wave, so the wave travels out along the arms, bounces off the mirrors, comes back, and adds up again at the beam splitter. And depending on how far the wave has traveled in each arm, when it bounces off the mirrors and comes back, You can think of it as a bit like the same as a water wave. If the wave comes back with two peaks in the light, they'll add up and give a bright spot. If, on the other hand, a gravitational wave has passed by, stretched out one of those arms so the light has had to travel further, squashed the other arm so the light's travelled a shorter distance, the waves could add up again so you have a peak and a trough that cancel one another out and you'd see a dark spot. And literally, when we look at where the two light beams add up again, we measure the intensity, the brightness of the light spot there to see, has a gravitational wave passed by and shaken the mirrors? Has it moved the mirrors? So that's the principle that we use, and we're sensing the brightness of that light spot to see, have mirrors in our instrument been shaken, been disturbed by a gravitational wave passing by?
And these are 4 kilometres long, isn't it?
They are very big. The paths the distance that each light beam has to travel, as you see, is it goes out 4 kilometres, bounces off a mirror and comes all the way back again. And again, that's built into the way that gravitational waves work. The further apart the objects are, whose separation we're trying to measure, the more they move. Again, it's built into general relativity, that effect. So the bigger we make an instrument, the more sensitive they can be. So these are huge devices.
So I said, you've got your two L-shaped tubes,
yep.
You've got your mirrors at the very end of them, you're sending them pinging along 4 kilometres down, all the way down,
yep.
It bounces back. In the event of there being a gravitational wave that passes through it, by how much will a 4 kilometre tube expand or lengthen or will shrink?
Okay, so the motions of the mirrors at the end are about a few times 10 to the minus 18 metres. So not very much is the answer, and that's why it took us 50 years to get to the point of being able to measure those. And to give you some scale, a human hair is about 100 microns, 100 times 10 to the minus 6, and a nucleus of an atom is about, I think, 10 to the minus 15. So it's a tiny, tiny
distance. So it's a thousandth the nucleus of an atom.
Yeah, I think it's actually a thousandth the size of a proton. Yeah, it's tiny.
Four kilometres and a bit.
And a bit. Yes.
So you've got two of these L-shaped tubes and they act as a kind of a check on each other.
They
so
do.
When events happen at the same time or within a certain amount of time,
yep.
That might be significant,
yep.
I think. But the events themselves, I mean, are they just instantaneous? I mean, if a giant event, and we'll talk about, I'm presuming what the events are that trigger this thing is, when they happen, is it not like a series of waves coming at it? Is it not a large thing? Or is it just passes through, it's just one ping?
So it depends what's produced these gravitational waves far out in the universe. And the first signal that we detected came from two black holes that had been circling round one another. They'd got caught in one another's gravity. They were circling round, orbiting one another, getting closer and closer together, faster and faster, until they eventually smashed into one another and made a new black hole. And the bit that our instruments were sensitive to were the last few wobbles, the last few cycles of those black holes causing space-time to vibrate before they smashed into one another. And then that signal, what we call a chirp, was sent out across the universe, and it travelled for 1.3 billion years across the universe before it arrived with us here on Earth and flashed through our detectors in less than a second.
Yeah, well, so, wasn't it about 2 days after you'd turned it on as well?
It was.
Just seems extremely fortunate, given that it took 1.3 billion years across the universe.
It would be no exaggeration to say it took us by surprise. It's true, actually. Our instruments were up and running. They'd been being commissioned for a couple of months. So we'd been working on them, getting it into a state of working. And they were working. But we'd set an official date by which we would declare that we were taking science data. But we were ready. And fortunately, we were, because 2 days or so before that official date, the signal came in. It was a big surprise to everyone.
Neil, I wanted to ask you, because you work in calculating what these things do. I mean, it's remarkable to me that a theory that's 100 years old can describe nature to that level of precision, and something that Einstein could not have imagined, that black holes existed, in fact, when he wrote down the theory. What, I mean, it's a remarkable achievement for theoretical physics, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you imagine the fact that this is a pure construction of Einstein's mind, he didn't have no experiments, he had some tests, you know, the solar system, motion of planets and so on, but he really didn't have any conception of the kind of things we're talking about. Gravitational waves he didn't quite believe in, more or less. The black holes, well, again, people didn't believe in properly until the 60s. There were no evidence whatsoever until X-ray observations and so on in the 60s. And so it is indeed astonishing that this theory passes every single test. And this is not, you know, it's kept on passing tests for this first century. And it seems to be doing brilliantly, it makes us jealous, I guess.
Now, in August, we saw the neutron star collision. So could you talk through what that event was, perhaps introducing neutron stars first, and then the question would be why that was so interesting and important.
Okay, so neutron stars is the typical endpoint of stellar evolution. So a heavy star either becomes a black hole, which is a very simple object, even though the theory is complicated, or a neutron star, which is probably the most complicated object we can think of, because what you do is you take an object that weighs a little bit more than the sun, squash it down to 10 kilometers, you have the strongest magnetic field we can imagine, so it's the strongest magnets in the universe, spins around faster than a kitchen blender, it has the hottest superconductor we know, so that's pretty much all the physics we think we don't understand on speed. And so two of these guys crash together, and that was what was discovered in August.
We were lucky in that we had a third instrument also operating. The advanced Virgo detector in Europe was operating. And a signal came in that this time, from looking at the way the wobbles were happening, the way space-time was vibrating, the frequency of those wobbles, we could tell it wasn't two black holes. Instead, it was consistent with two neutron stars spiraling in and smashing into one another. And we could tell that from the gravitational wave signal. Because we had a third instrument operating, a third observatory, the Virgo Observatory, we could also get good information about where this collision had happened in the sky, and very quickly were able to ask our colleagues with telescopes to point and look at that point of the sky. And what they saw was extraordinary. And smashing those stars together gave out a spectacular set of optical and other wavelengths of light that I think makes it probably one of the most studied events in recent history with telescopes.
So essentially it's an instrument which isn't like a telescope. You can't scan the skies with it. It's more like Alexa. It sits there waiting for you to say something to it, and then it turns the lights off, or whatever it does. It's like an always-on microphone,
yes,
just waiting to hear something occur.
Yes.
And then if you line them up the right way, then people can just all pile on to have a look at stuff where it's happening.
Yes, that's right.
And in terms of the collision of two neutron stars, this seems to have had, if anything, captured people's imagination even more than the black holes, possibly because of the element of bling, which, the idea of now understanding where gold itself is created. And platinum as well, is that right?
Platinum as well. Many of the heavy, pretty much all the material matter or the atoms heavier than carbon. So this event is spectacular for many reasons. It was many, many firsts in astronomy, and it was also totally unexpected. It was totally unexpected because even though we know these things should happen, we expected that the outflow of matter would lead to the production of heavy elements like gold. There was no one on the planet that expected we would actually see all of those things the first time around. As late as December, I think, last year, there was a meeting where I know people were talking, oh, this will be decades away. Don't worry about this now. Don't fret. It won't happen before we retire or something like that. And then it all came in one go. It was close enough that the optical astronomers could see this afterglow that faded away over days, which is the signature of the production of elements like gold. The radio astronomers could catch it. It's astonishing that the whole across the whole range of electromagnetic radiation from radio, infrared, X-ray, as Sheila said, we see one single, the first event. It's
just to say, wasn't it many times the mass of the Earth's worth of gold? This is a lot of gold.
It's a lot of gold. A lot of gold, yeah.
You say that you told me earlier it was on the cover of the Financial Times. It even made that. There's so much gold.
Only understand this idea if I could sell it. I could sell it, or I could gather it and made in it. That's the only way I can understand this physics of it. I think people are fine with the explosions. I think the explosions also work as a way of getting this idea across, yeah.
It's quite an exotic idea, though, that the gold in your jewellery was made, most likely, in a neutron star collision before the solar system formed. I think that's quite a powerful
idea. It is, and especially, the gold that's now placed in your headphone jack socket and will never be returned to the universe again, it's all in leaf form now. But what is it, you said there's 2 swimming pools worth of gold in total on the planet or something? There was
something like that, isn't it?
One of them's in his garden. There's a lot of money in sexy cosmology really pays, apparently. A lot more than pop music. Who would have thought? That's such a bizarre thing.
Dara, when you hear these kind of advances of our understanding, is there a little bit of you that goes, oh, maybe I should have kept with physics and not gone into show business? Or do you think I haven't got the patience to come up with an idea and then go, you'll probably be dead by the time we've invented the machine that's required?
You've very much answered your own question, if you know what I'm saying. I would have been happy to answer, but really you've supplied everything there. You've gone quite the journey. No, I think it's enormously impressive, but I think it was the kind of thing, I was more of a theoretical guy, but the notion of actually building a machine that precise, I can't build a Lego house that precise, and the pieces are laid out in grids. I'm step back and go, well done. I mean, because just the notion of how the stuff you have to eliminate there, mine would be all over the place. I'd have got bored of the tube long before I stuck any old mirror in. Oh, no one's going to walk all the way down to check. And let's just say they don't exist, will we? Let's just constantly just go beep and just let it go, because frankly, I couldn't be bothered working out how to do this. So, no, well done, Bev. That is amazing, level of precision.
We have we asked the audience a question, and this week the audience's question was, which stars would you like to see collide and why? And the first one is Proxima Centauri and Wolf 359. 2 red dwarfs colliding is bound to be lively. And this is a lovely kind of answer, because when our producer came up with this question, she went, I imagine everyone will confuse it for stars as in celebrities and do a funny joke about that, but not realising our audience will be very specific and will go with actual stars and the possible astronomical results.
Except for Daniel Fordham, who has said Robin Ince and Justin Bieber, so Robin can finally have decent hair.
Oh.
Not fair,
it's a bit cruel, isn't it, Dara and Neil? Yeah, I think all of us there.
Mike Williams suggested one, which he stars with Judge Clyde, and he said Beetlejuice, Betelgeuse, and Pollux, so we can have a star called Ball. I'm not going to read the end of that.
Brian Cox and a black hole to see what his hair looks like when stretched out. But will we actually see that, or will you still just be kind of, while you are being stretched and in agony, we'll still just be observing you kind of like that, won't we? You'll be on the edge in our
observations. You'd never see me fall in, would you?
No.
I'd just be red-shifted, wouldn't I, on the event horizon. And if it was big enough, I wouldn't get stretched, would I? So you'd just see my image. Just like fading away.
Really,
I'd be there forever. I'd be eternal.
Really drawn the humour out of that situation, haven't <I mean. laughs>
I've just got one for you, because you can do an impression of this.
Oh.
Brian Blessed.
Ah, I want to go to where?
And Brian May.
Can't do him.
Because the legendary guitar riffs would be heard throughout the multiverse. You have to sing Bohemian Rhapsody as Brian Blessed. That's the way to do it. Go on.
Mother, to kill the man! I had to kill him! He was looking at me weirdly.
Do you do impressions, Dara?
I don't do impressions, no. I don't. I can't even do an impression of you. I've worked with you for 10 years. I occasionally just go, billions! That's not pretty good. And I can't do it at all.
But Robin does a very good impression.
No, I don't. I can't really do it.
It's like a Camp Orville.
Yes. Some of the universe is really shiny, but some of it isn't. It's dark energy and no one knows why. Oh. Anyway, so anyway,
anyway, while we've been off air, we have received lots of questions inquiring about the nature of space-time and existence. And this week's question on space-time and existence is from William Minns, age 12. And he says, Dear Brian, my mum dropped the kitchen scales. Since then, we've been unable to weigh accurately. Is this a fault in the scales, or did mum dent space-time? Yours, William. Genuine letter.
It's a good question, actually, of what happens to scales in free fall. This is the basis of general relativity, isn't it?
That's right, but you have to warn the audience before we talk about this, right, because of health and safety, I reckon. So basically, Einstein got his idea for one of the fundamental things of general relativity called the equivalence principle by allegedly seeing a window cleaner drop off a ledge from a building opposite. And he drew the conclusion that if you took the bathroom scales and jumped out the window and tried to measure how much you weigh as you're falling, you would weigh nothing. But no, don't do that.
But the idea is, of course, that free fall is nothing's happening. You're not accelerating, are you? You're absolutely floating, minding your own business, essentially. And it's the ground that's the problem.
I mean, it's a bad way to mourn, to grieve with somebody when you go to the window cleaner's wife and go, I'm so sorry that the ground accelerated towards your husband at such speed. It really is unfortunate for him.
Anyway, William, I think the main thing is she broke the scales. So thank you very much for that. Would you like to add anything to William's question, Shino, or are you quite...
Not only to point out that gravity is not to blame and it's the electromagnetic force when you come into contact with the ground that really causes the problems.
Yes. Excellent. That has sorted that out.
Nothing to do with gravity at all.
Because they were all over the shop. That's made it. Thank you. I hope that's helped you a lot with
it. It is also true, though, that the scales do curb space-time, don't they? Mm. A little bit.
Yeah.
Very small bit. And you would get gravitational waves, wouldn't you, from the when the scales hit the ground?
You would, as long as they didn't do it in a perfectly spherical fashion, as long as there was some smashing involved, then gravitational waves would be produced.
Physics. The great thing about this is it's going out in January when loads of people had already given up on the diets they meant to do, so they are looking for an alibi to smash scales, and we have given it to them. Thank you very much for listening, and next week it's The Secret Life of Birds. Goodbye.
Do you know that nice again?
Hello, I'm Robert Innes.
And I'm Brian Cox.
Today's show is biological, so first we have to lure Brian in by making it appear to be about physics, because he's not really keen on living things or anything which have too complicated a structure or indeed an inner world. Even in a quantum universe, subatomic particles are more predictable than magpies and otters. And he doesn't like anything that can't be explained in a one-line equation.
That's going to get complaints now. People are going to be writing, and why do you hate magpies? Pies and otter. I don't even know what a magpie and otter is.
I know they're made of muons and gluons, but after that, I lose all interest. I have genuinely never met a human that smiles so much when he says the words, and eventually, the heat death of the universe. Oh, won't that be neater?
Well, it won't actually, will it? Because the heat death of the universe is a state of maximum entropy, so it'll be more disordered. So it'll be very unneat. It's a definition of the heat death, isn't it? It's the most highly disordered state.
So anyway, today we'll be talking about bird behaviour. Genuinely you are. So just to lure you into bird behaviour, I can tell you now that research into European robins suggests that they may maintain quantum entanglement in their eyes for the purposes of navigation. They're using this quantum effect to visualise the Earth's magnetic field. Quantum. Happy?
Well, not really, because you're not a European robin anymore, are you? Yeah.
Anyway, we're not talking about quantum entanglement. We're going to be talking about the secret life, by which we actually mean the sex life, of birds, but we have to call it Secret Life because that's Radio Times gets a little bit... Anyway, so...
To enlighten us on the lurid ornithological possibilities of nature, we have a zoologist, a naturalist and our regular theologian who has recently taken an interest in parrots. And they are...
I'm Tim Burkhead. I'm a professor of zoology at the University of Sheffield. I wrote a book called Bird Sense. I've just finished a book on the pioneering ornithologist Francis Willoughby. And the thing that really amazes me about bird behaviour is the issue of whether they feel and can express their emotions.
My name's Steve Batchel. I'm a wildlife television presenter. And the thing that intrigues me about bird behaviour is the murmurations of starlings, the remarkable flocking behaviour that they undertake before roosting in the afternoon and the evening. And it's like a billowing smoke cloud in the sky. And I still don't know how they do it and why.
I'm Katie Brand. I'm a writer, actor, comedian and amateur theologian. And the thing that most intrigues me about bird behaviour is how they judge so accurately the massive distances they cover during migration.
And this is our panel. Now, can I just throw this out to the whole panel, though? Is there a better word than murmuration? Murmuration is one of the most beautiful words to behave. It is magnificent. So you're already through to round two. Oh, it's not that not how the rules work. Okay.
Now, that's him. As Robin said in the introduction, we do a lot of physics on this programme. Physics, definitions are important in physics. So can we start with a definition? What is a bird?
A bird is a dinosaur. Recent discovery is that birds are not distinct from reptiles, they're just part of that dinosaur lineage. And it's well known now that lots and lots of dinosaurs had feathers even before flight was essential. So basically, a bird is a dinosaur.
So would all birds have one common dinosaur ancestor? Do they all go back to some sort of mitochondrial Eve dinosaur?
Well, they're in a group called the theropods. They're in essentially the same group as T-Rex was.
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah. All birds are related to the T-Rex. Could that be the case?
Essentially, yes. In fact, most modern taxonomists talk about dinosaurs and non-avian dinosaurs being all the things that we would think of as being dinosaurs. Everything from, you know, the brachiosaurs to the velociraptors to Diplodocus, all of which are non-avian dinosaurs.
It's interesting because you both reacted when I said, so birds are descended from dinosaurs, which is you both would say, no, they are.
It's one of those things, like people say, you know, we are descended from chimpanzees. We're not. We share a common ancestor with chimpanzees.
Yes.
And it's the same with birds and dinosaurs. It's not correct to say that they are descended from dinosaurs. They are dinosaurs.
Yes.
Now, in fact, we're going to just move on quickly. We're slightly going to change the order of what we're going to do because very often we have big, egotistical guests on this show who get agitated if they're not introduced on time. And this is one of those examples. Please welcome tonight's guest raven, but quietly. This is also introduced Lloyd Buck. Who, Lloyd, this is his wonderful raven brand, and we're going to...
That's the name of the raven, by the way. It's not a raven brand. Is what you're saying. It's a very strange way of saying it. It's
raven,
a raven
brand is one of my favourite cereals.
For the benefit of those listening, Bran is currently ripping large chunks of raw flesh from Lloyd's glove and just momentarily escaped for a minute just now. So,
yeah, so I should say for the radio listeners that Bran is quite large, although Lloyd, you said he was to me, he looks very large from about, he's a foot away from my head.
Yeah, like...
you said he's an average-sized raven, not particularly large.
No, he's just your average, normal-sized raven that you'd see anywhere in the wild, all over Northern Hemisphere. Yeah. So.
We're going to talk about intelligence in birds, but you were telling some stories about how clever he is, and you've known him all his life. So
yes.
It's 11 years,
is it? He's seven.
Seven years.
Oh, right, no, I don't want him to cheat.
That's all right, as long as he does it on that side.
I'm wearing some quite large hoop earrings, which I'm just going to take off.
Yeah, Bran flew very close to Steve's head then.
Bran and I are old friends. We first worked together when he was just a few months old, and it's always been working through elements of avian problem solving. And so what I've got alongside me here is what looks like the world's worst fish tank. It's kind of this perspex box, and in it is a food reward. But what Bran's going to have to figure out is how to get at it. And to begin with, you know, obviously what he's doing is just pure and simple trying to get through the perspex. He can see it, and he's trying to get at it. But he's going to have to figure out the way of doing it, because there's only one way this problem can be solved. And he's already got straight to the heart of the matter, which is that there is one weakness in this box. It's this kind of cover of paper here, which he's just, with surgical precision, removed. But that now he cannot get at the food. It's at the other end of the box, so he's going to have to pull it through using this string. And in a matter of seconds, he's solved the problem, he's eating it, which is... the audience all want to clap, but we told them they can't.
Yes, you're waving the hands in the air.
Oh, that's yes,
a remarkable thing.
But it is absolutely fascinating watching birds going through tests like this. And I've seen this many, many times. It seems like, to begin with, there is a period of experimentation where they're just trying out lots of different things to try and figure out how to get to the food. And he's now hopping around all over the stage.
He's now working out which member of the audience looks most delicious.
He's had to be tempted back.
But it's a fascinating thing as well, Lloyd, because you were saying about the intelligence, that there are some things that, say, a cockatoo may be able to do that a raven can't, but that doesn't necessarily... A cockatoo is not smarter than a raven. Is that right?
No, I think it's generally thought, I think Tim would agree with this, that ravens have the broadest problem-solving abilities of any bird, I do believe. They're all as different in characters, I would say, the birds, as you or I, and especially with the corvids. So Bran has a particular type of problem solving that appeals to him. So what appeals to him is this kind of thing, where he's got to work out how to break into...